I'm Nikki Strong, and this is VOA 1 The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, I tell you about this week's lockdown of China's Peking University. Later, Brian Lin presents this week's technology report. We close with the next episode of our U.S. history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Chinese officials locked down a major university in Beijing on Wednesday after one person there tested positive for COVID-19. China is continuing its zero COVID policy despite growing unpopularity. Students and professors at Peking University were not permitted to leave the property unless necessary. Classes at the main campus, where the case was found, have been moved online until Friday, a university notice said. Still, some people could be seen entering and leaving the main campus Wednesday. The university is in Beijing's Haidian district. Beijing reported more than 350 new cases in the latest 24-hour period. That is a very small number considering its population of 21 million people. However, it was still enough to start local lockdowns and quarantines under China's zero-COVID policy. Nationwide, China reported about 20,000 cases, up from 8,000 cases a week ago. Officials are ordering fewer citywide lockdowns to try to lessen the effects on freedom of movement and a struggling economy. They want to avoid a repeat of the Shanghai lockdown earlier this year that froze shipping and started neighborhood protests. The government released new national COVID-19 guidelines last week. The guidelines call on local governments to follow a targeted and scientific approach that avoids unnecessary measures. Peking University has more than 40,000 students across several campuses. Most are in Beijing. It was unclear how many students were affected by the lockdown. The 124-year-old university is one of China's top universities and has in the past been a center of student protests. Its graduates include leading writers, politicians, thinkers, and business people. Recent lockdowns in other cities across China have led to protests. Earlier this week, videos published online showed crowds pulling down barriers in the southern city of Guangzhou. The protests were in a crowded area that is home to migrant workers in the clothing industry. Guangzhou is an industrial export center near Hong Kong. It reported more than 6,000 new COVID-19 cases in what is the nation's largest ongoing outbreak. Other cities with major outbreaks include Chongqing in the southwest, Zhengzhou in Henan province, and Hohhot, the capital of the northern area of Inner Mongolia. Next up is this week's technology report with Brian Lin.
A new study has found that tools designed to warn drivers and automatically stop vehicles in emergency situations helped reduce crashes by about 50%. The study is one of the largest of its kind to examine the effectiveness of driver assistance systems. The research was carried out by the Partnership for Analytics Research in Traffic Safety, or PARTS. The organization is a partnership between automakers and the U.S. Department of Transportation's National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. For the study, numerous automobile manufacturers supplied vehicle equipment data on 93 different vehicle models from 2015 to 2020. This information was combined with data collected on more than 12 million police-reported crashes in 13 American states. One of the technologies studied is called forward collision warning. Collision is another word for crash. This system uses cameras, radar, and other technology tools to gather information on safe driving distances. It warns drivers if their vehicle is getting too close to other vehicles ahead. Another related driver assistance tool is known as automatic emergency braking. This system is designed to identify possible crash dangers involving vehicles ahead. The tool can automatically slow or stop a vehicle if it senses the immediate danger of a crash. The PARTS Group's study found that front-to-rear crashes were reduced by 49% when the striking vehicle had both forward collision warning and automatic emergency braking. The systems also reduced crashes resulting in injuries by 53%. The research also suggested automatic braking systems perform well in many situations, including poor weather and low-light conditions. The study also found that vehicles equipped with technologies designed to keep vehicles in their driving lane are effective in reducing single-vehicle crashes that lead to serious injuries. Many car makers now include this kind of technology on some vehicle models. It is designed to automatically keep a vehicle centered in lanes of traffic. The study found these tools reduced crashes involving vehicles leaving the roadway by 8%. Tim Chapp is an industry representative on the PARTS board. He also serves as a top executive at the Europe-based auto group Stellantis. He said in a statement that the latest study shows the driver assist technologies can substantially reduce the number of crashes and improve safety outcomes. Chep added that the results demonstrate real-world effectiveness that can help prevent injuries and loss of life. A separate study recently provided similar results. That study centered on crashes involving pickup trucks. The Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, or IIHS, carried out the study. It found that automatic emergency braking systems reduced rear crash rates for pickups by 43%. The study involved numerous pickup truck models and data from police-reported crashes in 25 states from 2017 to 2020. Jessica Cecchino led the IIHS research. She noted in a statement that pickups currently make up one of every five passenger vehicles on U.S. roads. Since these vehicles are larger and heavier, it can make them dangerous to people in smaller vehicles or on foot, Cecchino said. She added that even though pickup trucks present more danger, manufacturers have been slow to equip them with automatic emergency braking and other crash avoidance systems. Cecchino advised that the faster automakers can make sure that every pickup they sell has this important safety feature, the better. Both new studies confirm the effectiveness of some of the latest driver assistance systems. They followed another recent study suggesting that many drivers using such tools often treat their vehicles like they are fully self-driving. That study, also carried out by the IIHS, warned that drivers who put too much trust in driver assist technologies are putting themselves at risk for serious accidents. A majority of drivers in the study said they were more likely to perform non-driving related activities, like eating or texting, while using the tools. I'm Brian Lynn.
We just heard the technology report presented by Brian Lynn. Brian now joins me on the program to talk more about his story. Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking the time to be here.
Hi, Ashley. Of course. Thanks for having me.
In today's report, you explored a few studies that examined the effectiveness of some driver assistance systems. We learned that some of these safety tools are increasingly being added by manufacturers to new vehicle models. One term that comes up in the story is feature, which describes the kinds of driver assistance tools you spoke about. Could you expand a little bit on the usage of this word, though?
Sure, Ashley. The use of feature in this story, as you mentioned, relates to a certain element or characteristic of something larger. So in this case, the features I discuss include the different driver assist systems, such as emergency braking and crash warning systems.
Okay, that makes sense. What are some of the other meanings of the word feature?
Well, feature is also used specifically to describe different parts of a person's face. You might hear someone say a person has strong facial features. These could include the eyes, nose, or cheeks. In addition, the word is used to describe a certain kind of story that appears in the media. A feature story differs from a regular news story because it goes more in-depth to explore a particular subject. Feature stories are generally longer and contain more details about the people and subjects covered. So, in fact, even today's technology report is considered a feature story.
Can the word also be used as a verb?
Yes, it can. For example, you could use it in this way by saying, this week's podcast features a report on driver assistance technologies.
Got it. Thanks, Brian, for coming on the show to explain the word feature a little more in depth.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ashley.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning American English. I'm Steve Ember in Washington. James K. Polk moved into the White House after his swearing in as the nation's 11th president on March 4, 1845. Polk told voters during the election campaign he would serve only one term as president. During those 4 years, he wanted to achieve or reach 4 main goals. 2 of his goals related to money. Polk wanted to reduce taxes on imports and to establish an independent treasury. His other goals related to expanding the country to the Pacific Ocean. President Polk wanted to secure the Oregon Territory and California for the United States. Those who supported the president shared Polk's belief that the United States should extend from sea to sea, from the Atlantic to the Pacific. They felt it was God's will and their duty to spread American democracy and freedom across the continent. In the words of poet Walt Whitman, "It is for the interest of mankind that America's power and territory should be extended, the farther the better." One way Americans wanted to extend the country was by making the Oregon Territory part of the United States. The territory included what are now the U.S. states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, as well as part of the Canadian province of British Columbia. American traders established claims to the Oregon Territory early in the country's history. But British explorers gave Britain claims to the same territory. The two countries could not agree on how to divide Oregon between them. Since few white settlers lived in Oregon, Britain and the United States agreed to occupy the area jointly. This joint occupation worked well until the 1840s. Then, thousands of Americans began moving west to Oregon. The new settlers wanted all of Oregon to belong to the United States. President Polk agreed. He thought the United States had strong claims to the entire territory, but he said he would compromise. He offered to divide Oregon at the 49th parallel of latitude. Everything north of this line would belong to Britain. Everything south of it, including the Columbia River, would belong to the United States. Britain's minister in Washington rejected the offer. He said Britain would accept nothing but the Columbia River as the southern border of British Oregon. President Polk said America had no choice then but to claim all of Oregon. He seemed to say the United States would fight, if necessary, to defend its claim. Polk did not really want war, but he thought he needed a strong position to negotiate with Britain. In London, the British government decided Oregon was not worth a war with the United States. After all, Britain had moved its trading center on the Columbia River north to Vancouver Island, so there was no real reason to demand rights to the use of the river. The British foreign minister proposed a treaty that would divide the territory at the 49th parallel of latitude. The proposal was almost the same that President Polk had made earlier. The United States accepted the proposal. The treaty made the 49th parallel the U.S. border from the Rocky Mountains to the Pacific Ocean. South of this was California. An American government minister once described California as the richest the most beautiful, and the healthiest country in the world. The official said the port of San Francisco was big enough to hold all the navies of the world. He said someday San Francisco would control the trade of all the Pacific Ocean. There was only one problem.
It was owned by Mexico.
Historian Robert Mary wrote a book about James K. Polk. Mr. Mary says Polk wanted to bring California into the Union anyway.
So obviously he had some underlying ideas about how that might be done.
At first, the United States attempted to buy California from the Mexican government. But Mexican officials refused even to talk about selling California to the United States. When the U.S. Congress approved statehood for Texas in early 1845, Mexico broke relations with the United States altogether. President Polk ordered the commander of the U.S. Army in Texas, Zachary Taylor, to move his forces into the disputed area near the Rio Grande River. The river formed part of the border between Texas and Mexico. Polk sent a representative to Mexico in an effort to reestablish diplomatic relations. But the Mexican government refused to talk with the diplomat. General Taylor sent one of his officers across the Rio Grande to meet with Mexican officials. The Mexicans protested. They said the area across the river was Mexican territory. The movement of American troops there, they said, was an act of war. For almost a month, the Americans and the Mexicans kept their positions. Then, on April 25, 1846, General Taylor received word that a large Mexican force had crossed the border a few kilometers up the river. A small force of American soldiers went to investigate. They were attacked. All of the Americans were killed, wounded, or captured. General Taylor quickly sent a message to President Polk in Washington. It said war had begun. Taylor's message arrived at the White House on May 9th. A few days later, the president asked Congress to give him everything he needed to win the war and bring peace to the area. Some members of Congress did not want to declare war against Mexico. They believed the United States was responsible for the situation along the Rio Grande. They were outvoted. Later, Polk wrote, "We had not gone to war for conquest, but it was clear that in making peace, we would, if possible, get California and other parts of Mexico." Many Americans opposed what they called Mr. Polk's war. Whig Party members and anti-slavery abolitionists in northern states believed that slave owners and Southerners in Polk's administration had planned the war. They believed the South wanted to win Mexican territory for the purpose of spreading and strengthening slavery. The president was troubled by this opposition, but he did not think the war would last long. He thought the United States could quickly force Mexico to sell him the territory he wanted. So Polk secretly sent a representative to the former Mexican dictator, Antonio López de Santa Anna. Santa Anna was living in exile in Cuba. The representative said the United States wanted to buy California and some other Mexican territory. Santa Anna said he would agree to the sale if the United States would help him return to power. President Polk accepted the deal. He ordered the United States Navy to let the former dictator sail to the Mexican port of Veracruz. But once Santa Anna returned, he failed to honor his promises. He refused to end the war and sell California. Instead, Santa Anna organized an army to fight the United States. In 4 months, he built an army of 20,000 men. When General Taylor learned that Santa Anna was preparing to attack, he moved his forces to fight the Mexicans. Santa Anna sent a representative to meet with General Taylor. The representative said the Americans had 1 hour to surrender. Taylor's answer to Santa Anna was short. Tell him to go to hell. The battle between the United States and Santa Anna's army lasted 2 days. Losses were heavy on both sides. On the second night, the Mexican forces withdrew from the battlefield. Taylor had won. The victory strengthened Taylor's public image. He had already won the Battle of Monterrey, a major trading and transportation center in northeast Mexico. Other American forces also were victorious. General Winfield Scott captured the port of Veracruz and was ready to attack Mexico City. Commodore Robert Stockton invaded California and had raised the American flag over the territory. Stephen Kearny seized Santa Fe, the capital of New Mexico, without firing a shot. Still, the war was not over. President Polk's short war already had lasted for more than a year. Polk decided to send a special diplomatic representative to Mexico. He asked the diplomat to negotiate a peace treaty whenever Mexico wanted to stop fighting. A ceasefire was declared, but attempts to negotiate a peace treaty failed. Santa Anna used the time to prepare for more fighting. So General Scott ended the ceasefire. His men began their attack on Mexico City. The fighting lasted 1 week. Finally, the government of Mexico surrendered and Santa Anna left power. On February 2, 1848, the United States and Mexico signed a peace treaty. Mexico agreed to give up California and New Mexico, and Mexico would recognize the Rio Grande as the southern border of Texas. The war was officially over. But historian Robert Mary says President Polk suffered because of the conflict. The war with Mexico, Mary says,
ended up being a much longer war than he had anticipated and much more costly in terms of lives, in terms of money, and in terms of his political standing.
The war with Mexico also influenced the U.S. election in 1848. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.
That's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.